A federal judge sides with BP Exploration over their handling of a 2009 oil spill. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, exploring the reasons behind the high cost of health care in Alaska.
If you buy a car, it's a big purchase, but you know what it's going to cost you. When you go to the doctor, when you go to the emergency room, you don't know.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
A federal judge today sided with BP Exploration in a lawsuit brought by the U.S. government alleging two probation violations stemming from a 2009 oil spill. The government alleged that BP violated conditions of probation stemming from a 2007 Clean Water Act violation after an oil line froze and split, resulting in the spill. In his decision, Judge Ralph Beislein found that BP could not have known the pipe would freeze and break, and acted responsibly in addressing and cleaning up the spill once it was discovered. Beislein released BP from the 2007 probation, but did have strong words at the end of his order, saying if a similar problem should occur in the future, he would see the situation differently. He wrote, "BP is now clearly on notice of the potential that a freeze-up could occur within an 18-inch common line that is part of a loop line system, and that a freeze-up could cause the pipe to burst. It is incumbent upon BP to make sure this does not happen again." A BP spokesman says the company is pleased with the decision. A call to the U.S. Attorney's Office was not returned by airtime. A man who injected an Anchorage teenager with heroin before Christmas now faces four charges and $90,000 bail. Meanwhile, the 14-year-old girl remains in a city hospital. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
According to court documents, on December 25th, Sean Michael Warner was charged with delivery of controlled substances to a minor, tampering with physical evidence, second-degree theft, and contributing to the delinquency of a minor. The first three are felony levels, the fourth a Class A misdemeanor. The Anchorage police report that on the evening of December 22nd, the girl, identified only as J.D., went to Warner's West Side home. Two other men, 22 and 21 years old, were also present. According to Police Department spokeswoman Anita Schell, the 20-year-old pair are now cooperating witnesses. They told police that the girl said she was willing to try heroin, but didn't want to inject herself. Schell says Warner volunteered.
He tried several attempts to inject her and was unsuccessful, and then finally had her lay down on the bed, and he used his belt as a tourniquet on her arm and injected her with between 25 to 30 units of heroin.
Schell notes the heroin was China White, one of the purest and strongest available. The teenager was left on the bed.
At about 9:30 the next day, one of the witnesses found the 14-year-old girl face down in her own vomit. She was having difficulty breathing. They attempted to resuscitate her by using CPR, and that was unsuccessful. And at one point in time, Warner used a drug called Suboxone, which is given to heroin addicts to help in their recovery. That was unsuccessful.
Eventually, J.D. went into convulsions. After 4 hours, at 1:30 p.m., 911 was called.
It is a very long delay. Anytime somebody overdoses, there's a critical time frame in which, if they get medical attention, they can actually come out of it. But this is a very long delay, and now she's in a local hospital fighting for her life. She is still listed in critical condition.
Tests on the girl at the hospital showed she also had cocaine, meth, and marijuana in her system. The two men say Warner didn't want to call 911 because he feared police would find drugs in his house. By the time medics and police arrived to help the girl, he had locked drugs, needles, and other evidence into his bedroom, but said it was his roommate's. After the police left the home, Warner and one of the men hid the evidence in a trash bin behind a nearby restaurant. Later, the man, and now one of the witnesses, led police to the site. One of the three felony charges involves an alleged $900 theft in merchandise from Costco.
The witnesses said that Warner had stolen a $900 surveillance system from Costco, and the witness told detectives he didn't know where Warner got the heroin, but he said he was with Warner when he stole the system, and then he delivered it to a man shortly thereafter, and he believes that that's where the money came from to purchase the heroin, or possibly could have been a trade for the heroin.
Besides the $90,000 bail, Warner cannot be released without a court-approved custodian. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska's healthcare costs are among the highest in the world, and the state-chartered Alaska Healthcare Commission has spent the last year trying to figure out why. It's a complicated problem, and finding answers is not easy, but a lot of dedicated people from all aspects of the industry are giving it a try. APRN's Annie Feit has this first report in a series on the high cost of healthcare in the state.
About 18 months ago, the president of Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield in Alaska started hearing something different from his clients. Jeff Davis says after years or even decades of spiraling healthcare premiums, employers in Alaska started saying enough is enough.
They have always been an issue, but it has just gotten to the point where it's almost too painful to bear.
The average private health insurance premium is about 30% higher in Alaska. Health insurance premiums are a reflection of healthcare costs. Those costs are increasing at an unsustainable rate across the country, but they are especially high in Alaska. Davis says the reasons are all ones we've heard before.
It's distance, it's geography, it's transportation, and it's supply and demand. And in healthcare, I think supply and demand is a big part of that.
Davis is a member of the Alaska Healthcare Commission, which has been trying to figure out what's driving the cost of healthcare in the state. The commission just issued a series of reports that start to get at some answers. They compare costs in Alaska to states in the Pacific Northwest, Hawaii, and two low-population states, Wyoming and North Dakota. In most cases, everything from a basic doctor's office visit to heart surgery costs more in Alaska. In some cases, a lot more. Dr. Ward Hurlbert chairs the commission. He says it would help if the price of healthcare was more transparent.
Going to the doctor, going to the emergency room is unlike almost all other purchases that we make. If you buy a car, it's a big purchase, but you know what it's going to cost you. When you go to the doctor, when you go to the emergency room, you don't know.
Dennis McMillan is president of the 4-Acre Group. He spent the last 20 years trying to find affordable healthcare plans for nonprofits in Alaska. He says initially he was trying to find a silver bullet to solve the problem. He now knows that doesn't exist. But he says one key is for Alaskans to simply live healthier lifestyles. That's because the majority of healthcare spending goes for chronic diseases, many of them preventable.
People have lost sight that health is not because you go to see a doctor. Health is because you eat right, you exercise, you don't smoke, you don't drink too much, you don't do things that hurt your body. And that if you do all those things, you can have all the doctors and all the insurance in the world and you're not going to be healthy.
McMillan says overall, the problem is a depressing one because the issues are immense and the system is so complex. Dr. Noah Laufer, a primary care physician who was a member of the Healthcare Commission, agrees, but he thinks there are ways to nip at the problem. He says a renewed focus on primary care is one solution because it can keep people from needing expensive procedures or specialists.
For example, if I have a long-term relationship with you as a patient and you come in and you have bronchitis, in another setting, like an emergency room, I might want to get a chest x-ray. But if I know you well, and we're open tomorrow and on Saturday, and you can come in and get a chest x-ray, in fact, you could come in without an appointment and get a chest x-ray, just stop by and talk to me or my nurse, maybe we don't need to get one.
I've talked to many people about this issue over the last few months, and I asked nearly everyone if they're optimistic we can get a handle on healthcare costs in Alaska. The answers have varied widely, but Dr. Laufer is one of the optimistic ones.
The opportunity is that Alaska is small enough and still a tight-knit enough community. By that, I mean there's communication between everybody, that we could do something truly remarkable, and that would be great. Do a better job of caring for one another. That's exciting to me.
And as for those employers at the beginning of the story who couldn't take it anymore, Premier's Jeff Davis says they're calling for new kinds of health insurance plans to control costs.
18 months ago, most of what we're working to bring out in products wouldn't have even been considered by employers. But now they're really demanding that we have tools. And when they see them, they might not take us up on the offer, but they might, and at least those tools will be available there.
Those new tools include limiting which doctors an employee can visit, or even encouraging patients to seek cheaper treatment in Seattle by paying travel costs. Davis says it's a small piece of a big puzzle, and he says the overall goal is a simple one.
We're not going to reduce healthcare costs, but can we slow the rate of increase again back to sustainability? Can we bring our rate of increase here in Alaska to a point that maybe the rest of the country, you know, catches up eventually?
Davis and other healthcare commission members hope the data in the new reports will help spur a discussion and eventually action to help control healthcare costs. We'll look more closely at what those reports found tomorrow. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska State Troopers say a 42-year-old Tanacross man has died in a snow machine accident. Troopers identified the victim of today's accident as Carl L. Martin, Jr. Troopers responded to Tanacross about 12 miles northwest of Tok after receiving a 911 call. They say Martin lost control of his snow machine and hit a telephone pole. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, finding ways to save energy in rural Alaska.
A lot of the refrigerators in the village are very old and well beyond their time, and they consume more energy than the newer models.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Anchorage-based Alaska Communication Systems, or ACS, has lowered its annual dividend to shareholders by 77%. The telecommunications company says that will make the annual dividend 20 cents per share. That compares with the prior level of 86 cents per share. The company says for the year, this will let it keep $29 million in cash. Spokeswoman Heather Kavanaugh says the company expects a decline in federal support for a program that helps telecommunications firms in high-cost areas provide affordable service. It's also preparing for Verizon's entrance into the Alaska market and wants to pay down debt. Rural CAP, an organization which advocates for services for rural villages, has taken on the work of energy-saving upgrades for many of Alaska's most remote communities. Kent Banks, a coordinator with the EnergyWise program for Rural CAP in Anchorage, says the program has helped some of Alaska's most economically strapped residents save on energy costs. Currently, the program is operating with funds from Nana Regional Corporation.
This is a community development-based program. Well, initially, the first year, we went to 12 communities with the full program. And then currently, with NANA funding, we're going to be going to all of the villages in the NANA region. In the year of 2011, we've gone through six villages and, in fact, have crews working currently in five of the six with a completion in the village of Noatak.
Banks says the program is aimed at creating an awareness among rural homeowners on how and where energy is wasted. EnergyWise trained crews visit with residents to find out where vampire power is sucking up energy and raising costs in both old and new appliances.
We're roughly in the neighborhood of a little over 1,000 homes by 2010. And then this year in 2011, we'll be finishing up actually in January of 2012. We have pegged roughly 589 homes in the six NANA villages that we're visiting.
Banks says about 20% of utility energy costs to the homeowner can be saved by going through the EnergyWise program.
The dollar figure varies, of course, depending on the village, because the cost of fuel in some of these villages is somewhere near $10 a gallon. In the heating end of things, where we're seeing people that are spending upward of $8,000 a year to heat a home. It's about $1,600 a year savings just on the heating fuel. And then the electrical consumption will vary, of course, depending on the type of lighting they already have in place.
Most rural villages have diesel-powered electrical generation facilities. The EnergyWise program creates jobs, too. Energy workers, such as the ones brought into Kotzebue by Nana, are paid. A crew leader is hired and trained, then returned to their village and hire energy workers locally, who are in turn trained in energy assessment work. Banks says information on energy loss coming back from the villages will be put into a database. Nana is funding the program for all villages in its region. Banks says other Alaska Native regional corporations have expressed interest in helping with the program. The Rasmussen Foundation is contributing $2 million to expand their community asset building initiative over the next 3 years. It's an opportunity for communities to develop their own philanthropic organizations. KDLG's Daisha Eaton has more.
Candace Winkler is the executive director of the Alaska Community Foundation, a statewide nonprofit that works to grow philanthropy in Alaska. She says the expansion of the Community Asset Initiative will provide communities with training and assistance to develop local foundations.
We bring in national experts in the field of fundraising and community foundation work. This is a partnership with Rasmussen Foundation, so they're also getting some technical assistance from them. And they get re-grant dollars, so while they're trying to build their philanthropic funds, they'll receive some dollars that can be made immediately in their communities in the form of grants to nonprofit.
The initiative provides a 2-to-1 match for the first $25,000 raised. And Winkler says, importantly, when affiliates partner with ACF and Rasmussen, they virtually eliminate startup costs. ACF and Rasmussen launched the Community Asset Building Initiative back in 2007. The initiative created 5 original affiliates in Chilkat Valley, Talkeetna, Petersburg, Seward, and the Kenai Peninsula. In less than 5 years, those affiliates are worth more than $3.7 million. The selection process, Winkler explains, will be competitive.
We will have an application process for the next 4 to 6 months. We'll really be talking with people, determining which communities are interested, providing some technical assistance around the actual application process, and we'll be looking to select communities that we view are prepared and ready to take on the challenge.
The application process should be in full swing by springtime. Winkler says they've had great success with development of the first 5 affiliates, and Seward is the shining star.
Seward, really, in many ways, has a great story to tell. Starting with just really a dream, they now, 3.5 years later, have about a $2.5 million endowment. They were successful in receiving a $1.9 million unrestricted bequest from a Sewardite who had lived in their community for many years and had put the Seward Community Foundation fund in his will. Those funds now will be able to benefit the community of Seward for years to come.
Paul Ruppel is with the Seward Community Foundation. He says Seward has grown their foundation to $2.3 million in just 4 years, and the community of around 3,000 is starting to see the money make a difference.
This year, 2011, we've awarded close to $25,000 in grants. We gave a grant of $1,000 to the Moose Pass Library to purchase new books. We awarded $5,000 to the Seward Senior Citizens Center towards remodeling their kitchen. We awarded $1,000 to Save Our Seward Pets, an organization. They're going to use the money for spaying and neutering.
And the list goes on. In addition, Ruppel says the foundation funds have allowed the community to offer mini-grants of $250, a quick way to infuse capital into local nonprofits when they need it in a hurry. Ruppel explains the foundation has freed local nonprofits up from time-consuming annual fundraisers, allowing them to concentrate on providing important services. And he says the foundation has become even more critical as state and federal funding disappears.
We didn't realize it when we first started, but we're hearing back from the organizations that, yes, federal funding and state funding is being cut back. It's also being delayed, which gives financial crimp to some of the organizations, and we provide another resource for them to gather funds.
Rupel says it's a bit of work to get a community foundation started, but it's worth it.
It takes a little bit of effort to inform the public as to exactly what it is you are. Some people don't understand quite what a community foundation is. I equate it to, I used to play Monopoly when I was growing up, and the one corner of the Monopoly board is community chest. That's what I equate it to.
The Alaska Community Foundation is looking to add three or four more affiliates in 2012. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. Good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and BP.
New research shows northern southeast Alaska's sea otter population is growing slower than in the southern part of the region, but it's still expanding, which continues to worry fishermen and divers. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Will Ware goes subsistence fishing in Sumner Strait, south of Petersburg, but the administrator of the town's tribal government says he finds fewer shellfish there these days.
When you get up onto the reefs, you're seeing it's just completely shell-laden all over the rocks and beaches, and gumboot shells everywhere, shrimp shells. It's almost like a devastating sight to see on some of these islands and rocks.
The shells are leftovers from sea otters' meals. A few decades ago, the federally protected marine mammals were hard to find, but that's no longer the case. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and other agencies have been surveying southeast waters to determine the extent of otter growth. Wildlife biologist Verena Gill just released a new population estimate. It's 20,000.
The reason it is increasing, both in distribution and in number, is because these sea otters are just recolonizing where they were extirpated from.
Otter fur is thick and warm, making it a valuable commodity. Russian and later American hunters killed so many that they disappeared from southeast and most other coastal areas about a century ago. Then the state decided they should be brought back.
In the late 60s, the Department of Fish and Game actually translocated otters from some remnant colonies that were left in Prince William Sound and the Aleutians and took them over to southeast Alaska. And they've been increasing and expanding back into their original range since then.
400 otters were brought to the outer coast of southeast. Gill's new population estimate means their numbers have risen 50-fold in the past 45 or so years. But growth has not been even across the region. The south is seeing a 12% growth rate, while in the north, it's only 4%.
There isn't the habitat otters really like in northern southeast that there is in southern southeast. They tend to like water about 100 foot deep, and there is a lot more shallow habitat available in southern southeast Alaska with more of the kind of foods that they like to forage on.
The reintroduced otters have expanded from the outer coast to inside waters. It will take a while for large numbers to reach the mainland. But Gill says there's no doubt the population will continue to increase and spread out. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
This week, we're taking a look back at some of the important and favorite stories of 2011 from APRN and our member station reporters from across the state. Tonight, we'll start in Juneau.
I'm Matt Miller at KTOO in Juneau, and sometimes you start work on a story not knowing at first what you're really getting into. That was the case when I thought I'd help out Raven Radio in Sitka by reporting on the recent Article 32 hearing of Lieutenant Lance Leone. He's the only survivor of that crashed Coast Guard helicopter in Washington State. The hearing ended up lasting 3 days, very complicated issues, detailed testimony, a real tough story to cover fairly, and impossible to walk away completely unaffected by the heartache of the whole tragedy. I was thinking when I interviewed Kyla Kruger, wife of the pilot killed in the crash, that I was probably going to remember this story for a long time.
And this necklace happens to be one that the littlest one, who's now two, was 7 months at the time of the crash. It happens to be one of her favorite toys as a baby. She would play with it and chew with it on her daddy's neck, and she would do the same with me once I was wearing it. So it holds a lot of special meaning.
Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
This is Daisha Eaton at KDLG in Dillingham. Most of the time, I'm way out here in Bristol Bay. But in October, I was visiting New York City for a journalism conference at the same time as the Occupy Wall Street movement was getting started. So I walked down to Zuccotti Park. That's where I met Alaskan Stephen Keegan, who was installing stationary energy bikes to power the camp. I'm new to Alaska, so it was cool to hear an Alaskan talk about how being raised up here shaped his worldview.
If you spend the night there, if you get to know the people there, you will get in touch with a fierce sense of individuality that Alaskans have, that I grew up around and am very comfortable with. And if you're passionate about something, you can walk in and say, I want to start a committee to eliminate all of our fossil fuel burning in this park. I think it's a very Alaskan mentality to have an idea and do it. And what's great about this movement is that you have a community of people supporting you to do it.
In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
This is Lori Neufeld at KUAC in Fairbanks. Among other duties, I host the Alaska Live series of music and conversation with visiting and local artists. One busy afternoon, my coworker Greta Johnson persuaded me to interview her old West Valley High School classmate / hall locker neighbor, cellist and Suzuki Institute instructor now, Dane Johansson. I'm glad I trusted her enough to go for it. Here he is playing live in the KUAC studios and sharing a Fairbanks Suzuki Institute memory from his childhood.
And he used to bring up a trampoline with him to teach the kids rhythm on a trampoline.
Yes.
So he would set, he'd be up in the Great Hall and he'd set up a huge trampoline that he'd bring up to Alaska with him. It was pretty fun. I'll never forget Rodney saying this to me. He said, you know, Dane, everything in moderation, including moderation.
I love that image of the little Suzuki students jumping on the trampoline.
Mm-hmm, yeah, I think eventually he was asked to stop doing that. You know, obviously somebody probably got hurt or something. But, you know, back in the good old days, we had trampolines at Suzuki Institute, so.
In Fairbanks, I'm Lori Neufeld.
Tomorrow night, we'll hear from reporters in Anchorage, Nome, and Ketchikan. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. We had year-end reports tonight from Matt Miller, Daisha Eaton, and Lori Neufeld. APRN's Annie Fight reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, which has been providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.